So welcome, Lighthouse family, to Wednesday night Bible study. This is the fourth session in our stewardship series. It'll be the last one on finances. And I guess I want to get started with the two words that I think we need to dwell on a little bit before we get started, and it's a theme that I've mentioned in the first three sessions a lot, and that is the words intentional and disciplined. These words go a long way, not just in finances, but on our Christian walk and anything to do with stewardship. I think we're going to find that the words intentional and discipline will probably apply to all our other subjects in the stewardship series as well. It's kind of what sets us as Christians kind of apart from the rest of society, because it just seems like when we, I don't know if you ever do people watching at Walmart or whatever, you know, it's like, what are these people thinking? Just go through my mind, like what's going through their mind? And it's kind of like scary. Maybe I'm glad I'm not in their mind. But I think what sets us apart as Christians is intentional and disciplined, because when we walk through our life, we have someone guiding us. We have a guiding principles. We have a moral compass. We have things that appears that a lot of society doesn't have today. And it sets us apart. And I think it what allows us to fulfill our purpose. I think people wander and just lets life kick them around. And I see people aren't planning for their retirement. Young people aren't thinking about it. If you look at all the statistics, our government's not planning very well either for it, for the future. But we can, if we're intentional and we're disciplined. And I think that's one of the attributes that us as Christians following our walk, we will just naturally accumulate those characters. And those characters will help us be successful in everything we do. Not just finance, but our relationships, our faith walk, you know, everything that we do. Today is probably going to be the most like what a normal secular financial advisor would talk about. Okay, because I just want to go through this and how do you put together a financial plan. Given that most people don't have one, and I think your results are always going to be better if you kind of know what you're doing or you have an idea what you're trying to do, as opposed to just going through life and let it kick you around wherever it wants to kick you. So, you know, we talked about keeping our finances in the proper order, proper priority. We always want to value our relationships ahead of money. It's one of the Christian principles we have. But the first step in a financial plan is we need to determine your present status. And you want to detail all your expenses, get an idea of where they're coming from, where your money's going. And I know that I had a much tighter awareness when things were really tight, because I was, why is it so tight? I just did the rough math in my head, we should be fine, and then all of a sudden we got bills to pay and there isn't any money to pay them. So what happened? So I think when finances are tight, you might be a little more likely to have an understanding of where your money's going. But that means that for the rest of us, where maybe you've progressed in life and your income and to where it's not as tight, you still, for stewardship purposes, need to know where our money's going. Because sometimes I think we get blessed and we can turn around and be sloppy. And it's amazing how much money can just fritter away and not accomplish anything. And I remember growing up, my mother always used to say, the money goes like water. And it's like I was just a kid, you know. I go, I don't make any sense. Money's not water. There's coins and there's paper. But none of it's like water. But as I became a young adult and tried to balance my checkbook, I realized what she meant. Money goes like, where'd it go? So we need to take a hard look and figure out where it's all going. And I want to give an example. This is called a Starbucks illustration. If you have a habit, and this is an innocent habit, and there's nothing wrong with this, if you want to continue to do it, it's fine. It's not bad stewardship if this is a habit. Because we all have habits that we can finance, and if the Spirit says it's okay, we can continue to do them. So I'm not saying going to Starbucks is bad. I don't want anybody can, you know, get that from this. But just as an example, and I checked these numbers with Tammy because I don't know what you spent at Starbucks. Because I came up with $5. I said, well, you can't get much for five. Five, well, I used to get a whole meal for that, you know. Foot-long Subway, right? Where'd that go? But anyway, well, $8. Okay, I just settled on $8. She said, it's very easy to spend $8 at Starbucks. So if you go into work every day and you pick up an $8 Starbucks every day, and that's your habit, 5-day work week, $40 a week, 4 weeks a month, $160 a month, $1,920 a year, okay? Now, that by itself isn't the scary part. The scary part is if I was taking that as cash and saving it and not just putting it under my mattress, but investing it at, I use 10%, because the S&P over the last 5 years has returned about 11% a year on average. So that's just, you don't have to pick stocks, you can just pick an index, and last 5 years you would have been better than that. But if you take that $8 a day and you invest it at 10%, now at the end of 10 years, if you put it in your mattress, okay, you'd have $19,200 in 10 years, which is still a big number, if you think about it. But if you invested it 10% and let it grow, you'd have $30,600. Now, if you go 20 years, okay, I know we're thinking 20 years, you put it in your mattress, you got $38,400. But invested at 10%, you got $110,000. And in 30 years, $57,000 in your mattress invested, which is still a big number. But if you do the 10% growth and leave it alone and don't tap it and let it keep growing, $316,000. So if you think about that, you got an innocent habit of $8 a day. But if you invest that over 30 years at 10%, $316,000. Now, how many other things in your budget are you going to run across? Maybe you got to have your Starbucks. Some people I've seen, it's like taking a cell phone away from teenagers. You know, they like their Starbucks that much. But there are other things. When you go through your finances, you got things you can't control. Maybe utilities. Of course, you can control that a little bit with your thermostat, right? You can be efficient. Again, I knew my dad was always like, when I grow up, I am not going to do what he does when I was a kid. But as soon as I started paying the bills, guess what? I did exactly the same thing he did, which is, oh, I'm always the one turning out the lights. I'm always the one turning down thermostat or up, depending on what season you're in. But going through your expenses, determining the things you can't really change, they're necessities. Keeping the light bill paid, gas, electric, groceries, food. But what kind of things can you look at? Well, you can look at things like You know, how often do you eat out versus groceries? Now, I know groceries have went up a lot. Still not as much as a restaurant. So, you know, there are things you can do to try to create, I call it, positive cash flow. And then look into where you're spending your money and just ask yourself this. With the Holy Spirit helping you, is this what God wants me to do with this? Do I have other options? Can I do other things? Can I do substitutions? Can I do something cheaper, serve the same purpose? You know, what's the purpose for? And I go through all my expenses, and I call it efficient, frugal. And just keep in mind that illustration about the $8 a day. 3 Starbucks a day in 30 years is almost $1 million. Just keep that in mind when you go through trying to create some positive cash flow. And I think Jesse asked me a question once about, well, what if that positive cash flow you created and it shows up in the checkbook, but if it's in the checkbook, it gets spent? That's pretty common. It's hard for people to pull things out and separate, and that's one of the things you consider doing in your financial plan is separation. You know, one of the first things I did after coming back from a financial advisor's recommendation was create a separate checking account called a wealth accumulation account. And any positive cash flow that I was able to take out of my regular checkbook that paid the bills, I move it over. And move it over with the idea that it's not coming back. I'm going to keep this tight. I'm going to keep this going to where it needs to go. And everything that accumulates that's a little extra, I'm going to move it over. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to see an extra $500 or something, and then guess what? Our society, the economy, is geared toward parting you from your money. Everywhere you look, they're trying to say, you deserve a break today. Spend your money. So when we need to go through all our finances, our thing, and this isn't a one-time thing, because if you haven't done it in a while, you're going to be surprised at what you see in detail when you do your detail. If you haven't done it in a while, and you're going, wow, whoa, okay, there's where that went, you know, explain some things. But when you got your expenses down, you know, as good as you can get them, hopefully you're in a positive cash flow situation, which means that each month, you know, you have something left over, and then you can move it over to your wealth accumulation account for investing later, or for reinvesting, or for growth, or other things like that. But one of the first things that you need to have is an emergency fund. I think I read a statistic that over 40% of the households in America cannot absorb a $400 unexpected expense in a month. And that's just a statistic. And then once you get an expense that you can't cover, then you start doing extraordinary things to cover it. And they're almost always going to be very expensive. You're going to either take out a new credit card, you're going to do something, go to cash land. Don't do that. That's like a legal loan shark, basically. But it's very expensive to cover that expense if you start scratching, where am I going to get? Or you may have to sell something you really like, something you paid $1,000 for, and now you've sold it for $500. And then you know you're going to buy it back again. So you just kind of lost $500 to cover that expense. Okay, enough said on that. But an emergency fund is, you need to build that. Now, how big does that fund need to be? It depends. I mean, it should be, I would say, for a household, normal household, you know, $1,000 minimum would be a good. Now, you can get unexpected expenses that are more than that. If your furnace goes out, it's going to be a lot more than that, you know. And a lot of these contractors like that, they don't like payment plans, right? So where are you going to get that money? You're going to have to get it from a loan. You're going to have to get it somewhere else. It would be good to have that as an emergency fund. Doesn't mean that emergency fund can't be sitting somewhere earning interest at least or being put to use, but as long as it's what we call liquid, which means that it's available when you need it, then it can still be getting a return. I'm getting 4.5% right now on money market just sitting there in cash. So you can get something. You know, create a budget. And if you do create a budget and you're married, get together with your spouse. Any budget created by one spouse without the other one, you can create it, but then you maybe get it approved. Or make sure you're both on the same page. And if you're going to start making some, say, life changes, or maybe you're going through expenses and you're going to cut this back, or you're going to restructure this to create more positive cash flow so that you can invest to grow, make sure you both agree. Or make sure the cuts are even, or whatever you need to do to maintain your relationship, because remember, your relationship is probably more important than the money.
Yes.
Okay? So, then look at your debt. Probably you need to list all your debts with how much the monthly payment is, what the balance is to pay it off, how long is left to pay it off, and of course what the interest rate is. And the first debt that you should pay off is the one with the shortest term, not necessarily the highest interest rate. And Dave Ramsey, and when he first said that, I do my spreadsheets, and I said, but the numbers say pay off the highest interest one. But in reality, with human nature, it's good for you when you're starting down this road of being, you know, tighter, more frugal, that you see some rewards right away. And that's where you're going to see the most reward right away, because it takes less money to pay off a shorter term to get a bigger impact on the monthly payment. So you'll build, your cash flow will increase quicker by paying off your shorter term debts first.
Okay. So just to make sure I understand this, let's say I have three credit cards. Each of them has a certain amount on it.
Shouldn't have any of those. No, I'm kidding.
Right. In a perfect world. When we get to heaven.
I know.
Teasing. Let's say I have three credit cards, each at different interest rates. So let's say one is 17%, one's 23%, and one's, you know,
29%, 33%. Yeah, I've seen.
Yeah, they keep
going.
They're
in the 30s now, if you've looked at them.
So, but let's say on the 17% one, I only owe $600. The next one, I owe $2,000. And the next one, I owe $2,500. So you're saying go ahead and pay off the one that I owe the least on.
Well, credit cards might be a little bit of an exception to that. I'm thinking more of like a car loan or a term loan, where the payment is fixed. With
okay.
A credit card, your minimum payment is death.
Right. You'll never pay it off.
Never pay
right?
it off. So you really don't have, you should be paying a lot more than your minimum payment anyway.
Right.
So you're not necessarily getting that cash flow back because it's not an installment loan. But when it comes to credit cards, you would probably want to pay off your highest interest one first, if as much money as you can, and then, you know, make your at least your minimum payments on the other ones. But, you know, your credit cards are generally, if you pay it off each month, some of them you can avoid finance charges. But a lot of them, now are starting to do daily interests, so that even when you pay them off monthly, you're still accumulating some finance charges. I'm paying off my credit cards two or three times a month.
Just to keep that
to make sure I'm not getting almost any finance charges. Now, sometimes one credit card company will offer you a balance transfer at 0% for a year. The numbers say do it, because that takes some pile of debt, moves it over to 0% interest. But don't take that as a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. Still have to pay that bill,
right? You still got to pay it. Just look at it as good. I'm not going to pay as much interest, but keep on the same plan you had to get that paid off. Because I know some people that go have credit cards from every bank there is, and they try to do balance transfer payoffs from one to the other, and then from the other to the other, and to the other. You don't want to get into that. That's not going to lead to a good place.
Okay. So just to clarify in my mind, you're saying if you have several loans and you only have 8 payments left on one loan, you would finish paying that, and then what would you do with that money? Would you apply it to the next loan? Or would you start a savings account, or probably just different depending on what your financial need is?
I guess it would depend. For me, I would look at the interest rates you're paying on your different debts versus when you – the alternative is to put that money into your wealth accumulation account and you invest it. Well, you may not – maybe you need $5,000 before you invest it in something or $10,000. Or different financial institutions have different minimums for brokerage accounts and stuff to set them up. Now, if you're not there yet and you can't get any return, then yeah, you apply it against your credit card.
If it makes financial sense, your other debt. Okay.
You apply against your other debt. Okay, now, for me, you know, if I can get 10% on my investment and my home mortgage is at 3%, it don't make sense to me to take this money out where it's making 10% to pay off this, where it's charging me 3%. But I'm not using that. I'm not using that debt as just a free up to go out and spend more money somewhere else. That's the key. That's the key, yeah. If keeping a debt keeps you spending more money, then pay off the debt. If you don't have the discipline to do that, then pay off the debt. I want to talk a little bit about, so if you go through that, all your expenses, find out where you're at, try to get an emergency fund. And if you look at priorities, you know, I know when people are just getting starting out, reliable transportation. You need to be able to get to your job. Does that mean there are cases where it makes a lot of sense to upgrade your vehicle if it's letting you down and you need a nicer one, not just to be nice, but just to be reliable, then that upgrade is worth it. Almost any other vehicle upgrade is, by financial terms, not worth it. Vehicles are a depreciating asset. So the more money you put into vehicles, the more money you're going to lose over time. Now, I know we moved to Findlay. I realized I can walk to work 3 blocks. We got down to one vehicle. And we got by on one vehicle for 7 years. Not because we couldn't afford a second vehicle. It's because the inconveniences, and there were some, but they weren't worth as much as what I could do with that money that I could put somewhere else and grow it. You know, I didn't have the tags, I didn't have insurance, I didn't have the car payment, I didn't have, you know, gas, I didn't have, you know. So, but if you're commuting in 2 hours one way, then that's not an option. I understand that. Some of you have 401ks. I think a 401k with your employer is probably the primary retirement planning vehicle in this nation now. Fixed benefit pensions are few and far between. A lot of companies don't even have them at all. If they do, they're not near as lucrative as they once were. But a lot of employers offer a 401k. A 401k operates a lot like an IRA. And one thing to remember with an IRA is when you put money in, it's tax deferred, which means if you're doing it with your employer, the money that you're saving in your 401k isn't taxed. You don't pay tax on that. It goes in there tax-free from your withholding and from your tax obligation, you know, at the end of the year. But you'll pay tax on that whenever you withdraw it. And the other thing about these retirement vehicles is remember they're retirement vehicles. If you're saving up for a down payment on a house in the near term, you may need to put money in that instead of your 401k. Unless, the one exception is, a lot of 401ks have matching. You always want to put in, as a minimum, the matching. That's 100% gift. No matter what your taxes, no matter, you know, you can afford to pay taxes and a 10% penalty to withdraw it if you needed it for the down payment, still be ahead to make sure that you're getting the matching from your employer, whatever that number is. Some of those are quite good. I just saw the blurb about the strike at the UAW. You know, they're getting 6.4% matching and they're trying to get 8. When I left Marathon, there was 7. So, I mean, you want to at least put that in your 401k because they're going to match it. That's 7% money that you otherwise wouldn't have, and it's going to go into a growth account. And the fact that your IRA or your 401, it's deferred taxes, which means it grows this year, but you don't pay taxes on it this year. That growth that you had this year stays in there at 100% and grows more next year, and that growth grows next year. And there's no taxes paid. No taxes paid until you retire someday down the road. And then you'll start paying the taxes. But it's going to grow a lot faster because if it was just a conventional brokerage account, for example, and you're in the 25% tax bracket, then whatever your growth was that year, you're going to have to pay 25% of that growth to the government. And that's going to be 25% less in your account that grows next year. So to have these accounts are very powerful to prepare for retirement because they grow tax-free. So by their very nature, they're going to grow faster than any other account you're going to have. Now, 401s are, they're not an IRA until you roll them over later or you leave your employer and you roll it to an IRA, or you leave one employer, go to another, and you definitely want to transfer it. Always transfer it. You build up a 401k balance and then you change jobs, don't cash it out. Do not cash it out. You're going to pay tax and a 10% penalty. And your nest egg that was on the path for growth and tax-deferred growth restarts back to zero. You don't want to do that. There are so many, every 401k is different because the employer has a lot of latitude what you can invest in. Some employers let you invest in all kinds of things, some very much limited. They have all their own kinds of rules, and I can't go into that here, but how much of your 401k contribution is tax deductible also depends on your income. As your income goes up, it gets phased down, and there's income levels at which you no longer get your tax deductibility. So you can continue to contribute to an account that's going to grow tax-free, but it may not be tax deductible this year. And then there's recently, more recent, it's been around a while, but for me when I was 20s, it went around. And that's a Roth IRA. The difference there is you contribute to it with tax-paid money. In other words, you paid money, and then you contribute it to the Roth. But forevermore, it's not taxed. All the growth is not taxed. It's never taxed. And I see the government recommending, in a lot of cases, they recommend against Roths, but I think it's because they don't really like all these accounts that's going to grow tax-free. Have you ever noticed that what the government recommends for you to do isn't necessarily what's best for you? It's what's best for them. The same thing with Social Security. I know recently I had to make the decision to take it or wait till like I'm 70 when I get more. You know, and they would recommend, well, the math says, well, when I did the math, the break-even was like 85, and they're not valuing all that money I get early as no time value of money. Now, I'm going to put that to use, and I'm going to grow it for 20 years, and it's not even close. I should take it now for my benefit, yet they're out there recommending that you delay. And when I look at their balance sheet, the fiscal, government, I'm going to take it now. I'm pretty sure the rules are going to change, and then they're going to get worse. They're not going to get better. Another reason to take it now, in my mind. So that's a case where I would make a personal decision different than what, if you do the research, most of the financial advisors officially recommend to delay, but I wouldn't do it, and I didn't do it. But it's the same thing with a Roth. If you're a young person, there is no doubt in your 401k you should do it as a Roth. And you should put as much in that as you can possibly afford to do because it's going to be tax-free forever forward. And depending on how much money you're making as a young person today, there's a good chance that over the next 30 years of your career, if your incomes keep going up, your tax rates are going up. So your tax rates are never going to be as low as they are right now. Just something to think about. But when it comes to IRAs, Roths, 401s, the answers are always dependent on the individual circumstance and the individual company. And every company is different, so I can't give you a definite do this, do this, do this, because the answer to most questions is it depends. But for young people, I would say almost always putting the most you can into a Roth is going to be the best thing you can do. There's a lot, that's probably the biggest place for planning for retirement. You know, that we can do into what's available for us today. Because, like I said, those big pension plans just aren't there. And the statistics for Americans are not good about how well we are doing as a nation planning for our retirement. From what I can see, when they do forecasts of what's needed when you retire, like 10 years from now, versus the money that people have, are forecast to have, it's not close. Social Security isn't going to make it up. And people aren't saving. This vehicle's there, and over time, if you manage it, you can provide for your retirement. You don't have to have a high income for a 30-year career to end up with a big nest egg in your 401. No, you don't. You have to manage it. Managing it is more important than what your income is. But it's not just putting money in. They'll give you different investment vehicles to pick from too. And of course, if you do good, and you'll do better on some than others. But just getting the money in there and then leaving it alone and letting it grow is the key to that. Just some other things. Insurance is a big growing burden on everyone today. Everything about insurance costs more than it used to. Health insurance is probably the biggest one. Now, if you have an employer plan, they probably pay. I know Marathon paid 80% of the premium. So my deduction was 20% of the premium. You know, Tammy's still on the Marathon plan. And it's interesting because she said, what's our plan? I said, you're on the don't get sick plan. Because you know, we picked the lowest deductible or the lowest premium, the highest deductible. Because the difference between the two deductibles was the same as the premium. So it's like, I'm always, if I don't need it, then I save money. If I do need it, I break even. So why would I ever pick the higher premium? I don't know if other people's plans look like that, but that's what mine look like. And it says, well, so we don't get sick, we save the money. If we do get sick, we would have paid that deductible difference in the premium anyway. It's just something to think about. But I've noticed after retirement, being on Medicare, my insurance is actually much better than Marathon was. I think I paid $90 this year for an emergency room visit when they did a bunch of stuff. I would have paid like $600 with been with Marathon. I haven't paid anything for prescriptions. I haven't paid anything for co-pays. I haven't paid anything. And it's like if Tammy goes, it's like 100% out of pocket up to the first couple thousand because of the deductible. So hence, the don't get sick plan. No. But Medicare right now, I would say, is very, very good. Can it stay that good? I don't know. It depends. The government is going to have to fund it and keep it funded because it costs them, you know, to do that. But health insurance, if you don't have an employer-sponsored health plan and you're just working a job that doesn't provide that and your spouse doesn't have, young people can't afford it. I don't know what to say. I don't have a solution. They can't afford the premium to be self, to go out and buy a plan, the Obamacare plan or whatever it is. You know, if you're making $15, $20 an hour and you don't get any health insurance help from your employer and you have to put a kid in daycare or something, there's no way. You can't afford it. I don't know what you're supposed to do. I think it's a problem for the government, yeah.
Real quickly here about that, there are health saving plans that you can get involved in, and while it may not help you if anything major happens, if you are diligent and, like, going back to the $8 Starbucks thing, right, if you're disciplined and you put money back and you save it, that is a way that people who do not have health insurance through their employer, that they can have a health insurance, so to speak, and help offset those costs. And there's even share plans out there. I'm not too familiar with those, and I don't know much about them. I'm not recommending them, but I'm also not putting them down. But I do know, like, there's health saving plans out there, yeah, that you can use and at least have something, like you said, an emergency, yeah, fund, but also a health emergency fund that you can stack.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'm seeing is a lot of young people, hey, nothing's wrong, right? I'm healthy, I'm young, a lot of young people are uninsured. Until something happens like an auto accident, and then they have a six-figure bill. It could follow them because the hospitals aren't just writing these off anymore. The hospitals are suing people, and they'll garnish your wages for the next 20 years. I hate to say it, but it's reality. So consider something. Try to get insurance. It's just one of those things, like, it's great to save the money until you need it, and then, wow, we should have done that. Young driver auto insurance. You know, I know you're dealing with that now. But one thing I learned is, you know, Tammy and I had two vehicles. They both had full coverage collision. It was cheaper for us to buy a third vehicle to put the 16-year-old on as the primary driver and not have him on ours. And then that vehicle was a cheap enough vehicle where we didn't have collision either. We've saved enough on the difference in the insurance premium between adding the young driver to our vehicle or having their own vehicle, paid for the vehicle in a year and a half. So just, that's something to consider. Should always have insurance on your cars. Obviously, it's a legal requirement for one. But even things like hitting a deer, you don't have to have collision. Comprehensive will work, and the deductible is a little less. But one thing that I've been struggling with and haven't come to a conclusion yet with is long-term care insurance. This is for people getting older. Because I looked up the average price in Ohio for a nursing home. It's right around $300 a day, or roughly $100,000 a year. And that's standard care. You know, if you have something special, near needs, I mean, it could go through the roof. Now, what a lot of people are doing, over 60% of the people in nursing home beds today are getting paid by Medicaid, which means the person has run out of all their personal assets, depleted them, and now the state has taken over paying for them. So this is kind of like, it depends if you're an older person, if you're getting into those later years, how much assets do you have? If you don't have anything, then you can roll over to the Medicaid option and your heirs or whatever aren't really out anything. But if you have something to protect, you can consider transferring your houses, your assets to your heirs in an irrevocable trust, but it's got to be 5 years before. Because there's a five-year look-back period to protect those assets. And the only other thing to consider when I'm thinking about the care is the care's decent with Medicaid, but they call the shots. You do what they say. With private pay, you would have more say in doing different things, but then you're going to pay for it out of your own pocket. So, if you're able to afford that, it all depends, 20 years from now, what's the shape of Medicaid in our, what will they pay for? Maybe they're only going to pay for half of what they pay for now. I don't know. That's the future, right? But when you rely on the government, you rely on the government, and you get whatever they give you, and then that's what you're stuck with, whatever. So, wills, estate planning. The state of Ohio, if you pass without a will, then the state would administer your estate. And what they do, even if you don't have a lot of assets, they'll appoint an executor to usually a attorney, and then they're in no hurry or whatever to get it done, number one, or to do it efficiency on billable hours, let's say, so they could chew up a lot of the estate if you don't have a will. Because one of the things when you have a will is you appoint an executor, probably one of your heirs, and they won't charge the estate for. The other thing is the first thing we did, Tammy and I did, was we put all of our real estate in both our names. That way, if one of us passes, it immediately passes to the other without going through probate, without going through court. If you have accounts, brokerages, stocks, bonds, whatever, beneficiaries, designate all those beneficiaries. All those things pass outside of probate, and you avoid all those fees and all those other things too. And then just something about what?
Just throw a comment in here. Even if you have a will, but you do not name your beneficiaries, that will mandates that you go through probate. So make sure that, you know, if you're setting up for the end of your life and you want certain things going certain places, I would recommend that you go to an estate lawyer, pay the fee, have them set all that up, because we just recently learned that doing some things that even if you have a will that states this is where the money goes, if you don't have beneficiaries set up, then it goes through probate.
Yep.
And the people have to deal with the probate court, even though you have a will. So if you set up your beneficiaries, it just automatically goes right to them.
Yep. Yeah, we just updated ours. We had to change the church. But people change. I don't know what you have in your wills, but, oh, go ahead.
And also, if you have vehicles, you want to make them transfer upon death as well. So that way it doesn't have to go through. And you can do that with your, what's that called? When you do your title, you do a transfer upon death. So that way it doesn't go through the estate.
Oh, that's good, because my vehicles are in my name. I would hate, I may have to do that.
So when my uncle Charlie passed, you can only legally in the state of Ohio transfer one vehicle into your spouse's name, and they get it without fee or without paying for the vehicle again. So there was an old truck that my uncle had purchased off of a friend, and his son had gotten old enough and they wanted to gift that to him. Well, for that to be done, my aunt had to transfer the title of that truck into her name so then she could transfer it into the young man's name. Well, since she already did that, she couldn't take her main vehicle and transfer it into her name then, because they didn't have that set up. So she's absolutely right. You have to make sure that you have that set up, that there's beneficiaries of those vehicles, because you end up having to give that back to the dealership and go out and buy a brand new vehicle.
Yeah. So. Or pay sales tax. Yeah. Sales tax is huge. Well, I just want to make one more point, and then I'll open up for any general questions. I know there are some financially wealthy people who believe that they're better than other people because they have more stuff. I also know that there are a lot of poor people who think they have to stay poor, that they're defeated and a victim, and they can't change anything. And I just want to say they're both wrong. They're both very, very, very wrong. Because number one, your finances do not define you. You can define your finances. Because finances should never control you. Because remember our source. He's our source for everything. He's our identity. He's who defines us, not our finances. And especially for people who may find themselves in the struggling category, don't have to stay there. You don't have to stay there. I just know so many people that give up, or they just don't feel they can do it, or they've done it for so long, it's or maybe multi-generational, and it's just hard to believe in themselves. And that's where you need to get your identity from, where everything comes from, you know, as a source. Don't let your finances control you. So I just want to make sure that that's my, I guess, my last comment of everything. So if we have some questions about anybody has, you know, when it comes to investments, I mean, oh, just one more comment real quick. Vocation. I've noticed since I've retired that your job or your vocation is more than just about money. To a lot of people, it defines who you are. It's part of your identity. I know our identity needs to come from God first, but we can't help but identify with our vocation as kind of define who we are. We're a dentist, you know, we're an engineer, we're, what are we? And then when I retire, I lost that. You know, God blessed me to the point where the money side was better after than before. And yet there's a certain fulfillment that you get when you're doing a service, or you're accomplishing something, or you're interfacing with people, or you're doing something. If you're just making money, there's something missing. And that's why I offer my card in free services, because I need to feel doing something. And I would have thought, if someone said, well, what if you can make four times as much without working? Would you pick that? Well, yeah, okay. But if it's just money, it's not. When I got a 40-year career with Marathon, and my most satisfying was the first 5 years when I was building stuff as an engineer. It's kind of what we did. And then as you go on, it becomes more numbers and finances, and it's a lot more money, but you don't have the sense of accomplishment. Or there's just something God places in us with our purpose, that we're not supposed to just seek comfort. That's not what we're made to do. We have a purpose to serve. You know, whether it's a waitress, whether it's in healthcare, wherever it is, we have a purpose. Some jobs are much more rewarding than others. And you come home and you feel like, wow, I impacted a person today, or I did that today. And other jobs are kind of like, I made that company money, but, you know, their practices, they're, you know, a scam artist or something. So, I mean, with your vocation, look at your spirit, and my recommendation is change jobs if you need to. If you're working for a company that is contrary to your values, or making you interface with people, not in a service way, but in a negative way, or taking advantage of people, or that kind of stuff, because it's out there, and it's legal in a lot of places. But if you're going to do your Christian walk, it's going to wear on you to stay in a job like that. So I'm glad I got out of my company before they became more woke than they were before. But because I was having a hard time not speaking up about stuff that would get me fired if I did. And I see that's pretty prevalent more and more today. Anyway, there was a comment.
So we have it where we're having more come out for 401k for the 401k, but not in the Roth. Like we're at 6% there for the 401k and 2% at the Roth, and the company matches the 7%. Should we flip flop that to where we're putting majority of it or all of it just in the Roth, where the company matches and everything?
Well, depends on your personal circumstance, of course. But the one difference is you flip it all into Roth, your take home will go down.
Okay.
So make sure you could absorb that and make everything else work. Long term, I do believe the Roth is going to be better for you tax-wise and everything than the regular IRA, because it's kind of like you're trading in a tax deduction today for no taxes ever. And the IRA will grow tax-free while you leave it in there, but then you'll pay 100% tax on all the growth as well as your contributions later. Whereas a Roth, you won't pay tax on anything, not your contribution. Well, you pay it on your contributions to start, and then you pay nothing thereafter. So in the long run, the Roth is going to end up on an after-tax basis, probably being better than the IRA.
And then my other question is, like, we have two separate retirements. Like, she had an account she started when she was 18, and then I have mine through the company and everything like that. Okay. Should we roll that all into one so we have a bigger sum of money that's gaining, or keep them separate?
Well, that's a good question. It gets real complicated because your limits on what's tax deductible and not tax deductible, it's a function of income, and then it's a function of your tax filing status at the end of the year, whether you file married filing jointly or whether you file individually. So it would take an analysis to determine that. And I do know one thing is the IRS looks at all your IRAs as one. So you may have an IRA, you may have a 401k, you may have a Roth, but at the end of the day, they look at that's all one pool. So you're limited on being able to play games like, I'm going to take my tax-paid IRA money over here, I'm going to take my non-tax-paid over here, and it's like, you can't do that. They're going to just blend it all together, and when you make a withdrawal, you know, if you had 25% already tax paid, when you take the withdrawal, you're going to pay tax on 75%. You can't just take the tax paid part first. But the best thing to do is to work with your company on what rules they have in your 401. Okay. Because every company is different.
But, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So I have a question. Let's say I'm 52, which I'm not. Not even close. All right.
You youngster.
Yeah. So, and I have done a poor job investing. I've lived off my W-2 income. I'm at the point where I'm not wanting to work any overtime anymore. And I want to know how much can I invest per year in a Roth IRA? And do you think that would still be the best option to do at that point?
Well, a Roth is number one, you need to be employed. I can't do it with investment income. It's got to be W-2 income.
Okay.
And then they, if you're over 50, you can do a thing called makeup contributions. So you can probably do more than someone who's under 50. Okay. But I do know that there's an income limit. This year, I believe it's $6,500 up to an income of like $138,000 a year. Okay. But then if you get up, it starts phasing out really fast, and you get to $158,000 or $160,000 a year, you can't do any. Zero. It phases out really quick. So if you're under that number, I think this year it's around $6,500. And then if you're over 50, I think it's more.
So your annual contribution depends on your age and it depends on your W-2.
Your annual contribution through your 401k, they're going to look at your income. And well, I never did a Roth while I was working. There is what they call a backdoor Roth, which is you put it in as an IRA, and then you convert it later because they want to make sure you don't do something you're not allowed to do. Because I remember at Marathon, I would get to June or July, and then they would say your 401 contributions are no longer going to be tax deductible. Do you want to keep your designation, what percent I was putting in? Well, I was putting in the matching percent, so I want to keep on doing that, right?
Sure.
Even though they're not tax deductible anymore. But if I was putting in more than that, I may want to pull it back to the matching. But your employer will tell you what your limits are.
Okay.
They'll know. They have to match the IRS rules. And your employer usually won't let you withhold anything or do anything that's not legal.
Okay.
Normally, they shouldn't let you do anything. Oh, just one other quick comment that I forgot is just because you get approved for a loan, I know people have said, great, I was wondering if I should actually get that or not. Don't let a bank tell you whether you can afford something or not. The banks will lend plenty of people more. They'll give you more than enough rope to hang yourself. So don't let that be your guide. You determine whether you can afford to make the payments or whether that's a loan you should take or not. That's just something that I forgot to say. Well, I think we're at time. Is that good? You want to go?
Well, once again, praise the Lord. This is good, sound financial information, and it is an important part of stewardship, as we've been talking about, because sometimes our heartstrings are tied to our money. And so where our money goes, our hearts follow that. So it's important to know what God's word says about money and where we should put it and what we should do with it. So again, that's why the stewardship on financial responsibilities or what we do with our money is very important. So I want to thank Brother Jerry. He put all that material together himself, put his own time and effort into it. And again, if you have further questions, like Bo did, Jerry has some cards. He'd be more than happy to help you out. So if you have investment questions, tax questions, how should I begin to set up a retirement account, those things, Jerry would be more than happy to sit down with you and help you with those. Next week, we are going to move to the next section of our stewardship series, and it's going to be on time management. And Pastor Alicia is going to be teaching that. A very, very busy person, so she has to be very organized and structured with her time. And so she's going to give us some good instruction on that. Following that, we will be doing health and wellness, and then we will be doing spiritual wellness after that, along with spiritual gifts. There is a sheet in the back at the welcome desk that has some points and highlights for next week's lessons. So if you want to pick one of those up, again, they're in the back at the welcome desk. And just want to thank you all for coming out. And if you would, bow your heads with me and we'll dismiss in prayer. Heavenly Father, we just come to you in the name of Jesus, God, and we give you thanks for what you're doing in our hearts, God. Thank you that you're preparing us for what you have in store for us. And I just pray that you would bless each home, bless each family. God, give us safe travel on the way home. In Jesus' name we thank you. Amen.